This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Welcome to Chicago's Morning Answer. And we start this morning with some seeming tumult around the Trump campaign legal team. This after a statement was released by the campaign yesterday evening. Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. She is not a member of the Trump legal team. She is also not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity, quote unquote. That was attributed to both Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, two members of the Trump legal team.
Well, that's news to a lot of us because it was just last Thursday. I'm old enough to remember that last week where she appeared at a press conference with Ellis and Giuliani, and I thought they were a team, didn't you?
So the question is whether or not the campaign and the campaign's legal team is distancing themselves from Sidney Powell, or this is something that's orchestrated. If it was orchestrated for a particular end, you think that would be disclosed so that it doesn't present confusion and the thought that maybe some of what Sidney Powell has had to say in recent interviews rubbed Trump world the wrong way and they felt the need to distance themselves from her as they pursue their various legal challenges in various courts of law. But then you had this statement issued after that statement. Sidney Powell responding, I understand today's press release. I will continue to represent hashtag we the people who had their votes for Trump and other Republicans stolen by massive fraud through Dominion and Smartmatic, and we will be filing suit soon. General Michael Flynn's son, Michael Flynn Jr., said, can confirm this. Sidney Powell is now free to focus and not be tied down to having to vet everything through the campaign. Now, it is, technically speaking, my understanding is that Sidney Powell was never retained formally by the campaign, but clearly, as per what you just said, Amy, that she's presenting as part of an instrumental part of the legal team as per that press conference last Thursday. So I don't know exactly what we're to make of this, because on the one hand, she's saying nothing to see here, and this is all good, and I support the statement. But on the other hand, the Trump campaign provides no explanation of why the need to make such a statement.
Yeah, I mean, even President Trump tweeted, I look forward to Mayor Giuliani spearheading the legal effort to defend our right to free and fair elections. And he listed Sidney Powell on that tweet. And that was from November 14th.
Well, that's right, 10 days ago.
10 days ago, right.
What did she
do? What did she say? What you know, Tucker Carlson's always maintained, come on my show. Where's the evidence? And I just don't know if this is just getting a little out of control.
Well, it's creating certainly confusion because I'm confused. So if I'm confused, I suspect a lot of people are confused. Part of it, I think, may be explained by some of what Sidney Powell had to say again over the weekend on various interviews, including on Newsmax, where she talked about conspiracy that she believes occurred with respect to voter fraud. She talked again about the machines being turned off and the counts being stopped. But then she also said this about Georgia Governor Brian Kemp.
Yeah, that's a total farce. Georgia's probably going to be the first state I'm going to blow up, and Mr. Kemp and the Secretary of State need to go with it because they're in on the Dominion scam with their last-minute purchase or award of a contract to Dominion of $100 million, the State Bureau of Investigation for Georgia ought to be looking into the financial benefits received by Mr. Kemp and the Secretary of State's family about that time. And another benefit Dominion was created to award is what I would call election insurance. That's why Hugo Chavez had it created in the first place. But I also wonder where he got the technology, where it actually came from, because I think it's hammer and scorecard from the CIA.
Just to clarify, you're saying that Governor Kemp, who's been a longtime ally of the president, is directly involved because of financial benefit in the conspiracy to defeat the president in Georgia?
We have certainly been told that there is evidence of that, and it would warrant an investigation if anybody were actually going to do an honest investigation.
What more could you tell us about that alleged conspiracy? Is the governor's involvement?
I can't give you any more details on that now, but it would certainly warrant an investigation.
George,
if it had been reported to me as a law enforcement officer, I would be investigating it steadfastly.
Uh-huh. She is a former federal prosecutor, but my question to her is, as a former federal prosecutor, if you were still a federal prosecutor, would you make an allegation of felonious conduct against a politician publicly before there was any evidence presented to suggest that, before you moved on that politician?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
First of all, I don't like using the phrase blow up Georgia as the first state I'm going to blow up in terms of voter fraud and overturning the results as they stand today. Secondly, it is just wildly reckless, in my view, to make an accusation that Brian Kemp, or anybody else for that matter, is accepting bribes or some sort of election insurance, meaning the voting machine provider will ensure that you're reelected if you go along with their manipulation of the vote in favor of Joe Biden this time around. To make allegations like that, you need to present something other than just the, you know, if this was what I have heard, I would be investigating if I were in a position to investigate. That's just not good enough. I tell you, my thought when all this started to break apart over the weekend and into last night was, we have seen many otherwise serious people become quite unserious people during the Trump years. Yep. This is the Trump derangement syndrome. And I wonder if Sidney Powell might be a negative composite of the Trump derangement syndrome sufferer. Because publicly accusing Brian Kemp, like she did, without any evidence, is just irresponsible.
I mean, she's suggesting he was bribed. I mean,
that's what she suggested.
It's just too crazy. I mean,
the other interesting thing, you can't take this seriously anymore.
I mean, there is some voter fraud. Yes, some votes were turned over in Pennsylvania, but not enough to overturn this election.
Well, there are Pennsylvania is a whole separate matter, and there are constitutional issues. We'll get there. But the interesting thing is when Kayleigh McEnany was on over the weekend on Fox and Friends with Pete Hegseth, she was asked about essentially where's the focus of the campaign's legal strategy. Is it on the electronic fraud that Sidney Powell is talking about, or is it on sort of the nuts and bolts of things like allowing absentee ballots to be collected 3 days after the election in violation of state law in Pennsylvania and the curing of ballots in some counties versus other counties and so on and so forth, and the failure to check signatures on absentee ballots. Where's the campaign's focus? This is what she said.
Is the campaign prepared to make a larger one about electronic fraud, that potentially votes were changed? We hear a lot about that. Is the campaign going in that direction as well?
Yeah, and we know that Dominion in that one county, that 7,000 votes were changed, and we're looking into that. So certainly looking at the evidence there, but the equal protection claim is the really strong one and a constitutional one, and I think the winning one at this moment.
Translation, we keep all avenues open, but they're not focused where Sidney Powell is focused. That's the translation of what Kayleigh McEnany said. Now, whether that's an accurate representation of what Giuliani and Jen Ellis and the rest are doing, I don't know. But that's a translation of what she said. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I think their goal is to not gain votes, is to disallow votes to pull Biden under 270. Because the one scenario I heard is, if they do that and it goes to the House, then Trump will be the president. And I think they don't want her muddying the waters, Sidney Powell, and giving the other side an excuse to try to veer away from that goal.
There's a theory out there, yeah, Jim, that, right, if you can if you can prevent the certification of, say, the 20 electors in Pennsylvania, then you bring the threshold under 270 you bring Joe Biden under 270, I should say, and perhaps you can throw the election to the House. But I mean, that is really trying to draw an inside straight. But that is a theory that's out there. I just don't see that playing out. I think the constitutional issues that are raised in Pennsylvania are interesting, particularly because we still don't really have a handle on counts. I wish we could get a handle on counts, in whichever direction you want to go, and this is the subject of Andy McCarthy's writings over the weekend in National Review, some of what Dershowitz had to say in Bartiromo yesterday as well. But we don't know how many people did have their ballots cured. We don't know how many people could have had their ballots cured that didn't. Those are two important cohorts. We don't know how many ballots still were received after 8 p.m. on election day when polls closed in Pennsylvania. Right. And we don't know if they were segregated as per the order of Justice Alito. There's just, you know, so much of this turns on pragmatism, meaning courts looking at, are the charges alleged and the remedy sought, would they materially impact the outcome in a particular state? Because if they wouldn't, as I've said, and Dershowitz and others have repeated as well, is you're, especially the Supreme Court, they're not in the business of Pyrrhic victories. So if you don't have an evidence to that would materially impact the 83,000 vote spread in Pennsylvania and potentially turn that election over, then they're not going to take the case. And we just don't have a handle on these counts, no matter which direction you want to argue them from. Either it's allowing ones that were disallowed or disallowing ones that were allowed. Jason in Northlake.
Yeah, that is one of the good points. That wasn't what I was originally calling about. So if you just give me a second, I know you're up against the heartbreak, but part of it is just the fact that all these counts that they want to dismiss and stuff like that is that if that's not going to make a difference in the election, then it's a moot point. If you're talking about stuff that, you know, after that comes in around the 9th or something and it's only 300 votes, then it's only 300 votes. It's all moot. But getting back to the voter fraud with the machines and stuff, you got what Giuliani and she's saying during these press conferences. Then you got to look at what the actual lawsuits are being filed in these states too. And if they're not actually filing these lawsuits saying that these machines are fraud and stuff, well, then you know they're just blowing, you know, smoke out their butts.
That's right, Jason. That's a great point. And right now, the suits do not, none of the complaints that I have seen or read about include anything resembling the allegations that Sidney Powell is making. Now, again, she has time, the team has time, or Sidney Powell and the team, however you want to describe them, have time. And I'm happy to let them pursue their legal rights in course, and I'm happy to let this play out over the next couple of weeks. But it is worth noting that the allegations Sidney Powell is making have not been translated into actual complaints being filed in courts of law.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Is it time for this to end? Is it time for President Trump to concede? That was, of course, the question that was battered around the Sunday talkies, as it has been from the moment that Joe Biden had been officially declared the winner by the same individuals that chair the anchor seats on those Sunday talkies. One is Clinton Foundation donor zero, George Stephanopoulos, on This Week, putting the question to Chris Christie, erstwhile Trump loyalist.
Is it finally time for this to end?
Yes. And here's the reason why. The president has had an opportunity to access the courts. And I said to you, you know, George, starting at 2:30 a.m. on Wednesday morning, if you've got the evidence of fraud presented. And what's happened here is, quite frankly, the conduct of the president's legal team has been a national embarrassment. Sidney Powell accusing Governor Brian Kemp of a crime on television, yet being unwilling to go on TV and defend and lay out the evidence that she supposedly has. This is outrageous conduct by any lawyer. And notice, George, they won't do it inside the courtroom. They allege fraud outside the courtroom, but when they go inside the courtroom, they don't plead fraud and they don't argue fraud. This is what I was concerned about at 2:30 in the morning on Wednesday night. Listen, I've been a supporter of the president's. I voted for him twice. But elections have consequences. And we cannot continue to act as if something happened here that didn't happen. You have an obligation to present the evidence. The evidence has not been presented. And you must conclude, as Tucker Carlson even concluded the other night, that if you're unwilling to come forward and present the evidence, it must mean the evidence doesn't exist. That's what I was concerned about starting on election night, and I remain concerned today. I think it's wrong. I think what you've heard, lots of Republicans starting to say this. I said it on election night, and I hope more say it going forward, because the country is what has to matter the most. As much as I'm a strong Republican and I love my party, it's the country that has to come first.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you agree with Chris Christie that it's time to just end this thing and shuffle along?
Well, I mean, the fact that they came out and said that she's not part of the legal team when a lot of us had to suffer through that two-hour press conference, of course she was part of the legal team. So that, you know, that is an embarrassment. Yes, a national embarrassment. I don't know, but it gives great pause and gives you great concern. So, yeah, it's over. But on Friday, even President Trump, he had a meeting talking about, you know, the vaccinations that are coming forward for COVID. And he even claimed again on Friday that he's the winner. So is he delusional? I mean, is something coming down the pipe maybe next week with some serious lawsuits? But I just think it's over and he should end it. I'm sorry.
Well,
people aren't going to like to hear that. They're going to attack me on Twitter. But I personally think it's over. Well, yeah. Don't you?
No, I don't think it's over. Chris Christie is wrong to say, you know, all these U.S. attorneys. I know we're supposed to pay so much deference to U.S. attorneys and former federal prosecutors, and this goes in every direction. I just remind people again of sort of this soft tyranny of experts that is becoming less and less soft with each passing day. Your credential is interesting. Your professional experience is interesting and it's relevant. It is not dispositive because you may have some other motivations. What could Chris Christie's motivations be? Somebody sitting on one of the Sunday talk shows. Chris Christie knows better than to say what he said, which is the fact that you haven't presented the evidence means you don't have it. Not necessarily. That's one possibility, isn't it? Another possibility, particularly when you're trying to gather together evidence that is not easily obtained, is that 2 weeks isn't the requisite amount of time to gather such evidence. Isn't that a possibility? And so why, if you believe those things are true, and there are certainly enough statistical anomalies in incidents of wrongdoing or certainly irregularities, to use the phraseology, why wouldn't you pursue your legal rights within the time allotted?
And just like again, that, you're changing my mind.
Again, I mean, well, I just well, say, you know, I mean, yeah. why is everybody in a rush? What is the magic of December 1st or December 5th or November 28th or November 22nd? What's the magic of the date? The Republic hangs in the balance of conceding the election today versus 2 weeks from now? I just don't think so.
That's right. I mean, the end game is to have secure elections in the future. So I am glad that they're putting up this fight. It just gets the
yes, and oh, by the way, you know,
Rudy Giuliani,
and the actors here who are of interest are not exactly affording themselves well in terms of their transparency or their do whatever you want with under the law. We'll give you whatever you want. We want to ensure that everybody comes to believe what we believe, that this was as a free and a fair election as you can have on this mortal coil. But that's not the attitude. And to that point, state rep in Pennsylvania, remember Republicans control the legislature there, last evening Dominion Voting Systems lawyered up and backed out of their commitment to the people of Pennsylvania to provide input in a public format in which 13 million Pennsylvanians are entrusted. That's Pennsylvania State Rep. Seth Grove saying Friday after the news Dominion Voting Systems representatives canceled a scheduled appearance before the state government committee in that state. But yet Michael Steele, the newly minted PR flack representing Dominion Voting Systems in the courts of public opinion.
Oh, Michael Steele, you know, back.
Not that Michael Steele.
Oh,
okay. Not Michael Steele, the former RNC chairman. This is Steele with no E. But he is a longtime political operative. He's worked for people like Boehner and Paul Ryan and Jeb Bush. He's now with a PR operation in D.C., so factor that in as you listen to some of what he had to say in this interview that he gave on Fox News over the weekend. the statements he makes, but then why not, you know, maintain your willingness to go before oversight bodies, whether it's a state legislature or a House, a congressional committee, and answer questions. Here's what he said about the Pennsylvania.
They keep talking about they're asking for recounts in Milwaukee and Dane County in Wisconsin or in Pennsylvania. We don't have machines in those jurisdictions. In fact, in Pennsylvania, in the 14 counties where Dominion machines were used, the president won 52% of the vote.
Well, if there's nothing to see in Pennsylvania, then why cancel? I mean, this was not asked, but it should have been. Then why cancel the appearance before that oversight committee at the state level in Pennsylvania? By the way, the 14 counties where he was used, where Dominion machines were used, he won by with 52% of the vote combined. Though that's interesting. That is also not conclusive of anything, because we don't know what I don't know what the 14 counties were. So the question would be, well, what is the what did he get in those same 14 counties in 2016? And I know you didn't have machines, I guess, in Philadelphia this time around, but just because if there is fraud afoot, just because he wins some counties to give the appearance of there not being fraud afoot doesn't mean there wasn't fraud afoot. Again, I'm not advancing a conspiracy theory. I'm just saying there are follow-up questions to be asked. People make these statements. They take a data point. They just throw that out there and say, well, there it is. That's it. It's over. No more questions. Nothing to see here. Let's wrap this up. No, I don't think so. Here's what he also had to say about the fail-safe for the Dominion machines. It's not, you know, if you don't trust the machines, then trust the ballots, the printed ballots that come with them.
Well, it's physically impossible. Look, when a voter votes on a Dominion machine, they fill out their ballot on a touchscreen. They're given a printed copy, which they then give to a local election official for safekeeping. If any electronic interference had taken place, the tally reported electronically would not match the printed ballots. And in every case where we've looked at, in Georgia, all across the country, the printed ballots, the gold standard in election security, has matched the electronic tally.
Well, that again, except where there's been glitches in places like Antrim, Michigan, and in Georgia. And that is also interesting, but it doesn't address the theory, and it's a theory that is out there. The count stops because the algorithm's busted. And you can't bust an algorithm in terms of a trigger saying, we're below, for example, the margin of victory we need in Detroit, right? We know this in Illinois. It was always the handle as I was running campaigns coming up. You got to come out of Cook County less than 400,000 votes down to make it up downstate. Okay. So if you know if you lose Cook and the Collars by less than 300,000 votes, less than 400,000 votes, let's say you lost by 300,000, then you're a good place. You can make it up downstate. So it could be, and this is the theory, that the votes are stopped because the count in real time is that Trump is too close in Detroit. Let's just play this up. And so this is when you get the drop-shipped ballots come in the early morning hours on Wednesday morning, the day after the election, that flip the numbers overnight in places like Michigan, in places like Wisconsin, in places like Pennsylvania. Theory, because if you want to talk about the integrity and the vulnerability of whether it's a Dominion voting machine or if it's Smartmatic software, then let's play out these various hypotheticals to tell me why or why this couldn't have happened. That's all.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
John and Alsip.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So my comment is that this is the greatest Republican administration that we've seen in my lifetime, and it doesn't happen without President Trump. And regardless of, you know, even fraud or no fraud, President Trump should not concede under any circumstances, no matter what. 72 million people voted for this president, and he needs to just stay the course and stay in the box no matter what.
All right, thanks, John. Bob and Waukegan.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the 72 million votes that Trump got were all on the up and up, but everybody doesn't know about the Biden votes because of the mail-in balloting. Democrats don't traffic in truth, and this is like a big poker game
where everybody's sitting around with their cards. Some people are bluffing. Some people have the truth. And nobody in America can see their cards. So I got some wisdom dropped on me about 35 years ago from a Rhodes Scholar who was an associate pastor at our church. And we went out to breakfast together, and he said the most important thing his father ever told him was when you have a deadline, you wait until the last minute to make your decision because you have all the evidence before you. So if you have until midnight on December the 14th to present your case and you can get it in before then, you wait till December 14th because then you have all the evidence you can possibly amass at the appointed deadline.
All right, thanks, Bob.
And just so you know, 73.794 million people voted for Trump. Because it's a million more than people thought.
Right. Dan in Kenosha.
Hey, Dan. Hi, Amy. Amy, I like you. I like you a lot. But you know what? You're doing exactly what they want you to do, to give up. This is the party that burns squad cars down, burns cities, destroys people's businesses. This is the party. Did you forget that?
Dan changed my mind.
Do you think that they wouldn't steal the election?
I wouldn't put it past them.
These people are winocrats. They have been bitching. Excuse me for swearing. They have been complaining since Trump got in office. Now you don't hear a word from them. If things were turned around, they'd be burning cities up again, Amy. Don't give up.
Thanks for the call, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Tim in Woodstock.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, Chris Christie's comments really bother me. I think they point out a difference between the left and the right. While I disagree strongly with the left, they're willing to stand and fight. You know, they don't give up too quickly. And I don't know what putting the country first, that doesn't mean handing the reins of the country over to radical leftists before it's necessary. Until the fraud has been explored. And yeah, Sidney Powell may be hanging out over the handlebars too far on this. But you know, I think what Christie falls prey to and what other people fall prey to is they frame us as these right wing nut jobs that you know, that we're always looking for something that's not there. We just endured 3.5 years or whatever it was of this Russian hoax that came to nothing. We waited 37 days for Al Gore. There was information withheld before the election that we know would have helped Trump with the vaccine and so forth. Hysterical poll numbers that probably discouraged people from voting. And I say, let's hang in there. I don't care if Sidney Powell was over the bicycle too far. We got to hang in there with President Trump. He's a fighter.
Thanks for the call, Tim. It's a fair point you make, especially, right? We see things that aren't there, but we had to endure 4 years of being pummeled with things that weren't there, totally manufactured, and nobody, there's no consequence, there's no accountability, there's no reckoning there. I think that's right. And the other thing, I just go back to say, you know, if your opponent is engaged in all kinds of crackpottery, as is being alleged here, and is the otherwise destroying himself, destroying his credibility, right, even with among his supporters, that's the assertion, then why would you try to interrupt that? Why would you try to short-circuit that? Let it play out. If you're the left, let it play out. Oh, you have this allegation? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you come over and see whatever you want to see. Why are they in such a hurry as well? Because the transition is so important, because it's so meticulous. They're running it's running like a Swiss watch over there at Biden Transition Center. Come on. Come on.
It's not like he doesn't know, you know, Washington, D.C. He's been there for 47 years.
Yeah, it's just very curious. I would take full advantage of this. Whatever pet theory Trump has, we want to explore it fully. That's what I'd be saying if I was Biden.
Well, what about
if I believed what I'm saying? I'd say, come on, let's do it. Let's go down every rabbit hole you want to go down, because I want to make sure that everybody knows I'm right and you're wrong. This election was on the up and up, and the integrity of our elections has been protected in 2020.
What about Republican Senator Pat Toomey, though? He released a statement that President Trump has exhausted all plausible legal options, and he was calling on him to accept the outcome of the election.
Yeah, but Pat Toomey's wrong. He hasn't exhausted all legal options, and Dershowitz talked about that on Bartiromo. We'll get to that a bit later. Of course, this is the loss at the district court level is to move this along up to the Supreme Court. I mean, the whole play, if there is going to be a play, is to have the constitutional issues that are being lodged in Pennsylvania adjudicated by the high court. Of course, he has not exhausted his legal options. That's just factually incorrect by Toomey. Toomey's just, he's done with it. Okay, fine. But he has not exhausted his legal options. That is factually incorrect. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. No, he should. Trump should not concede. And I think Republicans like Christie, you know, Chris, if you think that the Democrats are going to like you for going along to getting along, mm-hmm. you're wrong again, because they're never going to like you until you concede to everything that they want to do. I have a question about it. I just saw something sent out by Cheryl Atkinson over the weekend. She's a serious person as well. Her source is the New York Times. It was sent out on Parler. I don't do Twitter, so I don't know. But it was New York Times data. Very interesting. It had the timestamp of all the Pennsylvania results coming in, you know, 3 minutes later, 3 minutes later. Curious, though, and it looked at Trump's lead and the erosion of Trump's lead over time, including a time where they stopped counting. And over in the far right-hand column, the analysis by the New York Times shows that all these batches of votes that are coming in with 2-3 minutes delay here, 2-3 minutes, 2-3 minutes, you know, things like that, are all in multiple quantities of 6,000 votes, give or take a couple. So it's like 6,000, 6,000, 12,000, 12,000, 6,000, which is quite curious, because if these are real data coming in, you know, real time, and there's nothing untowards or nothing weird happening with Dominion voting systems, why are real time batches coming in at 6,000? If it's an artifact of the machine and how it tabulates votes, that can easily be explained. It could also be easily disproved if Dominion will support and explain the way their software works.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, good news out of England on the vaccine front. More good news on the vaccine front, as Mike Scott's been reporting. The Oxford AstraZeneca group saying that the efficacy of its vaccine ranged from 62 to 90%, depending on the dosage given, with an average of 70%.
That's great news, because it doesn't need to be refrigerated, you know, kept in sub-zero temperatures. It can just stay in the refrigerator, so that's better than Pfizer's.
On the, yeah, right, in terms of the sort of logistical issues. Yeah, exactly. So that's some good news, but you know, no good news is received without dire warnings in lockdown and bust communities like Chicago.
Us?
Illinois.
Mm.
Dr. Emily Landon.
Oh, she's back, huh?
Right. She, formerly of Glee, I believe. She was on WTTW, that's Wilmette talking to Winnetka, that network. To talk about Thanksgiving and what you should do, in case you're confused.
Did
up
she
there
use
on the
her
North Shore.
School teacher voice, Dan, when she
She was a little less condescending than is her wont, but I think that on substance it was there. So what should you do for Thanksgiving this week? You know, stay home, talk to no one, sit in your chamber.
What should families do for Thanksgiving to celebrate it safely?
Stay home. Stay in your own home with the people that you live with every day. Now, I understand that some people really still want to get together, even in a limited way, with some family members. If you choose to do so, there are precautions that you can take, but the risk goes up exponentially every time you add different households to this Thanksgiving dinner.
And what if you've got college kids coming back?
Yeah. That's...
Well.
Oh, no. Do we have to put them in the shed out back?
Yeah.
Are we going to let them in the house?
They need to be wrapped up and separated from General Pop.
This is a personal decision for families to make about how they want to handle it. I strongly recommend that even if you get tested, that for about 7 days, you have these individuals are higher risk. They're being integrated into your family bubble. They could be bringing COVID with them. Mm-hmm. I recommend that they sleep on their own, that they eat on their own when possible, that they use as much of their own space as possible. And when they spend time in the same room with family members, they should wear a mask.
That's right. Hey, hey, Typhoid Mary, this space is not for you. You get outside. You go eat outside. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Will you be in your isolation chamber in your safe room for Thanksgiving?
No. And all these, you know, suggestions have one person serving the food in a separate room and six feet apart and all that. That is bull jive. And all, you know, a lot of college kids are coming home today, tomorrow. Some came home last week. And it is a personal decision. And we don't need her to tell us how we should act in our own homes. See what they're doing every day. They take and try and take more of our freedoms away and our family time away.
You know, it's interesting, too, with respect to what you're about to hear from the good Dr. Landon, University of Chicago's finest. What she had to say about vaccines, all this good news, vaccines over the last couple of weeks, Moderna and Pfizer and now AstraZeneca. And the report from the head of Operation Warp Speed, Dr. Slowie, he saying that may begin administration of the vaccine to American citizens as early as December 11th or 12th.
Yep, that's great news. That should be celebrated.
Well, that's not the timeline that Dr. Landon is on. And you should hear this, and she's a top advisor to Governor Jelly Belly, because this is an indication of maybe what the reaction will be in Illinois and in Chicago, even as Americans are being vaccinated around the country, ostensibly. Listen to her timeline versus what you know the timeline to be based on the head of Operation Warp Speed. Listen to this.
But we still have to finish the couple months of safety analysis. Some of the later enrolled participants are still undergoing that safety analysis. You want to make sure that they not just don't get COVID, but that they also don't have any side effects from the vaccine. Once that's been accomplished, then these companies can apply for emergency use authorization through the FDA. Their data safety and monitoring boards are made up of independent individuals who review the data. They are not part of the study, and they provide these interim analyses, and they'll provide another one. And if they have sufficient numbers of events to say that their vaccine really is effective and they have not had too many sort of negative side effects, then they can apply. They'll advise these drug companies to apply for an emergency use authorization. It's going to take a long time for the vaccines to make a difference in the way we live our lives.
Excuse me?
Did you hear that?
If it's FDA approved, we can take it.
Her blabbering on
like she's so important, she knows all, and being condescending. I'm sick of her. He needs new eyes on his team.
Well, I mean, just listen to what she said. She's either not paying attention to the timeline that these drug companies and the FDA are actually on, or she's suggesting that they shouldn't be on that timeline. And this really would be a wonderful question for the governor.
Yes.
When she said that, just that last statement that she made about, you know, vaccines are not going to change our lives for a long, long time to come. So what exactly do you have in mind, Governor? Because I'm sure a lot of business owners and just Illinois families in general, obviously, would like to know that even when a vaccine is online and, they run through the different cohorts of people beginning to get vaccinated, and even when, as we did over the summer, even when the caseloads decline, then we're still going to be under these same quasi-lockdown protocols? This is going to be the new normal in Illinois for as far as the eye can see? That's a question.
Don't say that. You're going to give me a heart attack. Because looking at all these business owners and then talking to some this weekend, they can't pay their mortgage. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their property taxes. They're barely hanging on.
Am I misunderstanding or mishearing what she said? Isn't that what she said?
Yeah, no, that's what she said. Yeah. That vaccines are not going to change our the way we live for a long, long time to come. And that's not true. And Dr. Fauci pretty much said something similar. He said, well, even though we have the vaccine, it's not going to go away. Well, no, you know what? Because we still have chicken pox. We still have HIV. We don't have a vaccine for HIV, but we have a vaccine for chicken pox. That doesn't mean it's going to go away. It's still here. So he's scaring people still. And I don't know why they're still trying to scare us into compliance. Is it because of Thanksgiving? They're just trying to buy time until the vaccine comes out to everyone and is available?
Paul in Paul in New Lenox, you're on Chicago.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Long time no here. I've been retired, so I don't get up as early. But this whole thing about lockdown, I truly miss your show, too, getting up, and I'll listen to the podcast. I'll force myself. But Harrison Bergeson was, but Kurt Vonnegut Jr., future where they weighted everybody down. And if you try to break free by taking a bead off, you have these beads around your neck. They would penalize you by, you know, putting you in jail. But that's what it reminds me of. I don't know if you ever read the book, but it's a great read.
It is a great read. Yes, Harrison Bergeron, that is a great book. And this is, you know, it's a different form of that dystopian future that we're living now, it would seem. And, by the way, this against the backdrop of something else we may be learning.
What?
A quarter of us may already be immune to coronavirus without ever being infected.
I can believe that.
1 in 4 people may already be immune to coronavirus, according to a new study, without ever having been infected. Public Health England followed 2,850 key workers from police, fire, health services to gauge levels of immunity. Researchers found that by June, a quarter had high levels of T cells, which recognized the virus. It suggested they had some level of protection against the bug, yet nearly half had never been infected. So here we go again, and this is something that Rand Paul and others have advanced too, that the level of immunity in the population is much higher than has been suggested by the so-called experts, particularly those that are promoting the lockdown and bus policies. And to that end, there's this really good talk given by Dr. Michael Yeadon, who is an allergen respiratory therapeutic expert with 25 years in the pharmaceutical industry. He's a trained biochemist and pharmacologist, PhD from the University of Surrey in 1988, and so on and so forth. He was a VP at Pfizer. He is an expert in respiratory illnesses and viruses. Listen to what he had to say about what the experts said at the outset that was wrong. One of the fundamental premises we started from that was wrong. We started from the same premise here in the U.S.
Sage has got several fundamental things wrong, and that has led to advice that's inappropriate and not only has had horrible economic effects, but has had continuing medical effects in that people are no longer being treated properly. Sage took the view that since SARS-CoV-2 was a, quote, new virus, that they believed there wouldn't be any immunity at all in the population. So I think that's the first thing. I remember hearing that and I puzzled because I already knew, because I read the scientific literature, that SARS-CoV-2 is 80% similar to another virus you may have heard of called SARS that moved around the world a bit in 2003. And more than that, it's quite similar in pieces of it to common cold-causing coronaviruses. So when I heard that there was this coronavirus moving across the world, I wasn't as worried as perhaps other people were, because I figured that since there are 4 common cold-causing coronaviruses, I figured that quite a lot of the population would be exposed to one of those viruses and would probably have a perhaps substantial protective immunity.
And still we cling to this 90% of the U.S. as potential exposure, 90% of the U.S. as vulnerable. And, of course, we make no distinctions between different age groups, and we make no distinctions on comorbidities and so on and so forth. Every case is treated as a death sentence, and every person is treated as sort of equally vulnerable to coronavirus. Still to this day, 8 months in. At least that's the way it's reported, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And we have this.
Scare you.
We have this reporting, too. This is from Fox 32 in Chicago. COVID deaths top 100 for a third straight day in Illinois. This is why nobody watches
local news.
The network affiliate news. Is why? Because it lacks context and consequence. Top COVID deaths top 100 for a third straight day in Illinois. How many people die a day in Illinois?
I know the answer. 300. Before COVID ever happened, 300 people die a day in Illinois.
Right.
And of those 100 a day or that, you know, around there, how many had other comorbidities?
We don't get that information.
No, we don't. And the people, the hospitalizations, about almost half of the people that are hospitalized didn't go to the hospital for COVID. they're in the hospital for other issues, and everybody gets tested every day, and they're not being treated for COVID. They're being treated for something else, but they have COVID. So that's considered and labeled a COVID hospitalization. And they won't pull that info out for us, and it drives me nuts.
And based on how they've communicated about this and what they're still communicating, based on the false premises from which so many of these experts started and the recommendations they made initially that they flipped on any number of times, you're going to take their advice and counsel or abide their demands, as it were, to not interact with your family or your friends? To just allow your business
going.
To allow your business to be taken.
I mean, did anybody see the long lines outside of stores? This is not a sustainable process because you can only have allegedly 25% in, and some companies are abiding by it, others aren't. I was at the Salvation Army, and the line was wrapped around the building, and it's going to snow tomorrow. I mean, this is not no one is going to be making money for the holidays.
Well, and I still go back to this, too. So on the one hand, they take these positions and they're just locked and then they flip on them when it becomes untenable to hold them anymore. But when it is they are able to ignore information that runs counter to their viewpoint, they do ignore it. So when it comes to the dubiousness of mask wearing as some sort of panacea, when it comes to the prioritization for vaccines, where childcare workers are like the third group in line, why did we not discuss a Yale University study, 57,000 childcare centers, childcare operations around the country, finding that there was almost nil transmission between children and adults? So why would I'm not picking or choosing. I'm not arguing against child care center workers. I just, in the prioritization speaks to vulnerability. Well, we know there's virtually no vulnerability in that environment, so why are they prioritized in the first five groups?
They shouldn't be. And just so people know, Eric Holcomb, in the governor of Indiana, he's got a plan, a vaccine plan. The first batch is going to a hospital in Muncie, Indiana. You can see his whole plan. Do we have a plan? No. The plan is, there is no plan of rolling out this vaccine when it comes into our hands. It's just mind-numbing.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
How disorganized they are.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. Good discussion this morning. Did you guys see the news clipping that Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, that's Rahm's brother, said seniors should not get the
He's got vaccine. Another plan for seniors, yeah.
If you're 75 and older, you better watch your back.
Actually, it was 65 to 75,
oh,
and children should get the vaccine first.
Why?
I wonder how the science works that on that.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, if you're 75, Zeke Emanuel's got another sort of vaccine for you.
Come into my chamber.
All right, well, let's take a break. But when we come back, I want to get to this moment of resistance, to borrow a word, in Buffalo. Some business owners have had enough. We'll tackle that right after this.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and as the recount continues in Wisconsin, another recount being pressed by the Trump campaign in Georgia, this time not just to do the audit, but to do a full canvas where they can challenge things like the issues of the quality of absentee ballots, signature matches, those sorts of things, to actually challenge the vote totals there. President and his team, buoyed by the support he still has from Trump loyalists, no question. Many of these events are organic, just as they were during the campaign, not even campaign orchestrated. Well, one of the events that an event that is being orchestrated, not that it's coming from the campaign, it's coming from Ali Alexander, is the National Organization for Stop the Steal. Organizers of the Million MAGA March from the other week and the MAGA Thanksgiving Day Parade and Protest, which is happening in Chicago on Thanksgiving Day at noon in Grand Park, And the walk, I guess, is going to be from Trump Tower to Grand Park. Well, that should be interesting. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the said Allie Alexander. Allie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
So give us the genesis of the Stop the Steal Thanksgiving Day events and the details on the one happening in Chicago.
Well, all across the country, we're going to our fourth week of Stop the Steal protests. We're meeting at every state capital in the country, and that's been going pretty well. And we had our march in D.C. where we had hundreds and hundreds of thousands. And what we figure is we not only need to stop the steal with this opaque ballot counting process that's happening across the country, but we got to also fight these lockdowns. I think the politicians have just pushed us too far, and we're trying to put them back in their place. So some of us are coming into Thanksgiving to support the locals to have a civil rights march against Lori Lightfoot's lockdown orders and her recommendation that we cancel Thanksgiving and just let the politicians know enough is enough. You can arrest all of us if you want.
When you were in Washington, D.C., what was the atmosphere like? And were you under attack by Antifa or BLM members?
Thanks, Amy. It was euphoric. I've been doing this for 14 years, organizing at the grassroots level for the conservative movement and the Republican Party. And I've just never been to anything like it. It was super organic. You know, we hired security, so we were pretty safe. We recommended that people go indoors at night. You know, not everybody took that order. And unfortunately, because of the way the roadblocks were set up, it allowed Antifa to pour in. And again, as somebody who's been going to D.C. for 14 years professionally, I'd never seen the D.C. police put up roadblocks 2 and 3 miles out and then not take those roadblocks up after the event. In fact, we got 30% more roadblocks. So people were left without the ability to get Ubers or Lyfts or travel. And unfortunately, that created an awful situation where 200 Antifa went roaming looking for victims. And it was a really strange situation, but typical for D.C.
I haven't heard whether or not Lori Lightfoot has given the shoot to maim order yet on, on you and your colleagues. But what do you anticipate in Chicago based on, again, you were just describing what you've seen elsewhere? You're definitely everywhere you organize, you're going to get those agitators like the Antifa folks who believe that violence is an okay way to express their political views.
You know, one of the main organizers there, Robert Cruz, is working with police. And so we're very grateful to be, you know, letting them know what we plan to do. You know, we're also bringing in our own security. But at the end of the day, you know, I tell our security team is, you know, I'll listen to you 9 out of 10 times. And the other 1 out of 10 times, this has to be a spiritual decision or political decision. And so it's not something that really factors in my mind. The safety is the concern of professionals. And my concern is to send a statement to stand up for our civil rights, our natural rights, and inspire others to do the same.
And so what do you think the reaction is for those Republicans? You know, more are starting to sing from the same hymnal as, say, Mitt Romney and telling the president to end the legal challenges and let's just move on to the orderly transition of power.
Yeah, I think that that's probably the natural course if this was a political challenge. I think that our ballot boxes were compromised. I think that, you know, Dominion is only the tip of the iceberg. So in a lot of ways, if I was advising one of these politicians, you know, I might say, you know, let's just go along to get along. But this isn't just some conspiracy that the president is tweeting out. We know in Georgia, for example, that a bunch of these signatures from the absentee ballots do not match the government, what the government has on file. But because of a 2019 law, very strange, we can't go check those signatures yet. And so each state has its own unique problem, and then usually also a universal problem because of these COVID laws and these COVID mandates and how it affected voting. So our job at StopTheSteal.us is to stiffen the spines and say, hey, let's make our way through the legal process before we certify elections. That way, everyone's bought in on the election, no matter who won. And we'll primary any Republican in 2022 who stands in the way of us getting a conclusion to this election.
And it's hard to imagine. I mean, Joe Biden getting 79.8 million votes.
Bull crap.
Well, President Trump, I mean, he got almost 11 million more votes than he did in 2016. So people love him. And I know, we all know Trump supporters who would do anything for him. But do you think what you're doing is actually going to make a difference?
Yeah, I think it already has. I think that Trump would have conceded in the first 5 days had we not started protests the next day after. So the day after the election, Wednesday night, we were in three states with probably about 150 people. The next day, we had about 500 people in five states. And then on that Friday, we had 1,500 people. And then we said, hey, everyone, go to your 50 state capitals. It was a tweet, Amy. It was a tweet. I didn't have Fox News' support.
Wow.
I didn't do a radio tour. It was a single tweet, and we had people in all 50 capitals. We had 30,250 people from a tweet. And so we're growing, and we are the majority. And I'll tell you this, you know, as a guy who works on campaigns, an incumbent president getting more votes and carving into the Black community and the Hispanic community and the senior thing being a myth and crushing it in Florida and Ohio, and you're going to tell me that he's going to lose 5 points with white men? This is just total BS. Any political scientist worth their salt knows that as many people as they say vote in this election did not vote. I actually think that Donald Trump didn't just get 74 million. I think he may have actually got the 80 million. And I think the same machine that y'all are familiar with in Chicago exists in other places. And we all know it's a dirty secret in America. And I think we ought to talk about it in the open. The American public ought to know what happens in L.A., in Chicago, in New Orleans, and Philly. They ought to know that there are parts of, you know, private enterprise, let's call it, that have worked with our government in the past to do some things.
You made mention that the events on Thanksgiving are also in part a protest or a cri de corps of freedom, a protest against lockdown policies. I think there are a lot of people surprised. You know, there's some people that were saying, oh, no, if Joe Biden wins November 3rd, November 4th, COVID is gone. And I never believed that. And clearly that is not the case, because these politicians in at least the COVID enthusiast states love the lockdown policies. That's all they know. And so the message that you hope to bring with the events on Thanksgiving Day, I assume it's something very similar to what we saw in Buffalo over the weekend.
I miss the events out of Buffalo.
The businesses protesting a county health inspector and sheriff's police coming into their business.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're having a Boston Tea Party moment. It's like, you know, you've encroached upon us to the point where we can't keep open our small businesses. There's a million small businesses that have gone bankrupt. We don't even know the cost of these quarantine laws across the United States. So let's open up and survey the damage. But people are bankrupt. People are killing themselves. People are going to get divorced because of this. This is just insane at this point. And I've been very bullish on the virus. Okay, I lobbied the White House to close down air travel to China. I lobbied for an original 2-week quarantine. I'm a guy who takes this virus very seriously. At this point, we're just committing suicide, and I'm over it, and we're not going to tolerate it. And what I'll tell you this, is that I agree with you, Dan, and I told people, I said, if Biden wins, this is the beginning of it. Because one, they have to validate Biden's insane arguments and those insane optics. And plus, they mean to take control. They mean to eventually open up the border. They mean for one world currency. They mean to have passes for travel. This is not a conspiracy. This is what left-wing politicians in all countries have pushed for hundreds of years.
He is Ali Alexander, National Organizer for Stop the Steal, stoptheSteal.us, organizer of the Million MAGA March from a couple weeks ago, and coming up Thanksgiving Day, the MAGA Thanksgiving Day Parade and Protest in Chicago. That is, it starts at noon, a walk from Trump Tower to Grand Park. Trump Tower to Grand Park, noon on Thanksgiving Day, MAGA Thanksgiving Day Parade and Protest. Ali Alexander, thanks for joining us, and good luck with all of the events.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Amy, and I'll see you soon in Chicago.
All right, thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy. This is something Amy might have organized. Maybe she might still in Chicago.
What?
Gathering of 50 business owners at a gym in Erie County, Pennsylvania, Buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
In Erie County, New York, in Buffalo, I should say. This turned into a bit of a confrontation when a health inspector came in.
I love this video.
These people actually
love it.
For their money, and they don't want to lose their livelihood. I've lost friends, I've lost family who've killed themselves. I've seen clients die because they've lost their livelihood.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know you are, and I'm just I'm asking for you to guys have some compassion for the people that have lost everything.
We do have compassion for people who
okay, well, you need to go have compassion out in the parking lot. This is private property.
This is
private property. This is private property.
Yes, it is.
It's private property. Go
I
get a warrant.
That.
Listen, man, this is private property. They're not wanted here. So do your jobs.
Well, her job is...
Well, no, your job is to remove people that are not wanted here.
You have a permit.
We're wanted here. They're not.
She's hiding her name tag.
I'm not. It's right here. It's marked here. You can see my name tag.
They're just doing their job.
There we go.
You should all be wearing masks. How
come
you have masks on?
Don't worry about my health. My health isn't your concern.
You're meant to be wearing a mask. It's a government.
Okay, well, then write me up.
It's the law.
Okay, then take me to jail.
It's not the law.
Then take me to jail.
Show me the law.
Show me the law. Show me the law. Well, I think we got to go.
You have to leave. You guys have to leave.
You have to leave. Right now, you're trespassing without a warrant.
We're not trespassing.
Yes, you do.
Come back with a warrant or
you
leave.
Don't write the law.
Outside. No, go on your phone outside. Go on your phone outside.
I would really like it if you
where did you hear the report?
Okay, we would like it if you didn't write the law. We would like it if
you leave. Who reported it?
You know what? I don't know.
Yeah, it's anonymous, right? It's anonymous.
It
can't be anonymous. You need to know your accuser. You need to know. It cannot be anonymous.
Okay, you gotta go get a warrant.
It cannot be anonymous.
You gotta go get a warrant.
You don't get to violate the policies. You don't get to violate the Constitution. It does not matter. You don't circumvent or subvert the Constitution.
Okay, Miss, you need to leave.
And they chased them out. They chased the county health inspector and the sheriff's police out of their business with 50 business owners.
And the business owners should know if they don't have a warrant, they cannot come into your property. They can't come into your establishment.
Well, that's arguable on the health inspection side.
Well, I like what I said better.
But I appreciate the sentiment. I appreciate the sentiment for sure.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and another statistical anomaly about the 2020 race. First time since 1960, it would appear, that a Democrat wins the presidency of the United States while his party loses double figures in seats in the House. And that's what's happening in the House with still a handful of races to call. Specifically for House Republicans, the pickup's driven by women. There'll be 26, at least 26 women in the House Republican caucus come 2021, tracking right now for 30 with four of the races that are yet to be called. You have four Republican women leading those races. Now, I loathe getting into identity politics. I hate when Republicans do it. I hate playing that game. It doesn't work out well for conservatives, nor should it, because it's the content of character is our standard. But it is still noteworthy because you want to attract people that unfortunately have fallen prey to some of the sentimentality of the left. And so they want to see people who look like them reflected in office. And that's somewhat understandable, which they'd scratch below the surface a little bit more. But nonetheless, it is exciting when you have candidates, now congresswomen like Maria Elvira Salazar in Florida, who unexpectedly took out that putty-faced communist molester of dogs, Donna Shalala, down Miami way. That was huge. Right here in Illinois, Mary Miller, this is a Republican hold seat, but Mary Miller is a real improvement over John Shimkus in the Illinois Republican caucus, such as it is. Mary Miller is also married to Chris Miller, who's a state rep from Southern Illinois. They're both very conservative, great story, raised four amazing daughters, and that's very cool. And also, we mentioned her before. We're going to be mentioning her again, particularly if she continues to speak with this sort of moral clarity. Victoria Spartz from the Indianapolis suburbs, who, again, that was a hold Republican seat, but nonetheless, a Ukrainian immigrant who has a real appreciation for the difference between capitalism and socialism.
I grew up in socialistic country. It actually was, Socialistic Republic of Ukraine. I was saying, in my 42 years, I grew up in socialism. I saw what happens when it runs out of money and it's not pretty. And now I came to America 20 years ago with a suitcase after meeting my husband in the train in Europe, and he is a raised and born Hoosier. And now we're building socialism. I'm kind of going full circles. I can tell you what is going to be next. It's very sad for me to see that. And that made me, as a mother of two daughters, it made me get involved and do something about it, because that's not very good for our country.
Indeed it isn't. And glad that she got involved. Nothing is more compelling than those who've lived under what is being proposed by the left. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Olivia Perez-Cubas, director of Winning for Women, former media director for Senator Marco Rubio's presidential campaign. Olivia, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mentioned a few of the highlights from incoming freshman Republican women in the House. Give us your perspective on this class.
Yeah, you covered so much of it. But, Republicans have made great gains among women this cycle, and we did surprisingly well in the House, in large part thanks to Republican women. You also mentioned identity politics at one point, and I often get asked that question because to some people, I work for a super PAC dedicated to electing more Republican women, and to some people that does sound like identity politics. And I always like to just remind them that, we go in and we find the very best candidate. We make sure that whomever we endorse and we support is the best person for that district or that state. And when it happens to be a woman, we go in there and make sure that she's got the resources that it needs to be competitive and to compete and go toe-to-toe with her opponent on the left, who oftentimes, a lot of these women face Democrat women who get incredible amounts of funding and resources, in large part thanks to groups like Emily's List. And after the 2018 midterm elections, where only one new Republican woman was elected to the House, we asked ourselves why is this happening, because there's no shortage of qualified Republican women. At the time, there was no shortage of qualified Republican women who ran for office, but they weren't winning for whatever reason. So that's why we launched our organization. It has been incredibly successful, as you kind of went through the gains made this year. And just a reminder for us that it wasn't by accident that when Republicans invest in quality women candidates, Republicans win elections. And we're really excited about it and looking forward to making more gains in future years.
Well, let's talk about New York City's lone Republican member, Congresswoman-elect Nicole Malliotakis. Did I pronounce her name correctly? I probably did.
Yeah, Malliotakis.
Oh, I was kind of close. She wants to form her own squad of new Republicans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, again, so many of the seats that Republicans took back were from one-term incumbents, and I do think that it is a testament to how far and how extreme the left moved over the last several years. And for a lot of these districts, a lot of these voters, it's too far, talking about the Green New Deal and socialism and Medicare for all. And voters kind of course-corrected this cycle, and it's a testament to the races that our candidates ran. But Nicole is also Cuban-American, Greek-American. She knows and has heard stories about the dangers of socialism. Her parents fled a communist country. And I do think, kind of rallying around these kind of conservative ideals and liberty and freedom and building a new squad of people who can promote those ideas and kind of be a counter voice to the extremism that we're seeing out of the left.
And we have to understand that as conservatives, Republicans, you're never going to catch up to the Democrats when it comes to women, because so many of the men identify as women. So, I mean, they sort of have an advantage there. But I did want to ask you address something else about this, just women, men, Republicans. That's not enough. So who are these people? What's their attitude? What are the issues they're going to stand for? And I like the fact that I read a piece in the Daily Signal. At least 14 of the new House Republican freshman women are pro-lifers. And I know a number of them are also outspoken school choice advocates. So, it's oftentimes I find that conservative women have a lot more courage than so-called conservative men. And so, hey, if that's what it takes to lead us down the proper policy path, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I think on both sides, conservative women are a little bit, I found, and women are not monolithic, right? But stick to their guns. I think sometimes if it's in the interest of their constituents to reach across the aisle and be bipartisan, you're going to see women candidates do that. And even when it's not, you're going to see them stick to their guns and stick with their values. And it's interesting because you saw Senator Joni Ernst in Iowa, who also polls had her down and folks were worried about her race, ended up winning by, I think, 6 points. And one of her biggest issues that she ran on was the fact that she was bipartisan. But Joni is also a tried and true conservative. So it's nice to see people in Congress who will do what is in the best interest of their constituents, regardless of if it's easy or hard.
And I think in 2024, regardless of what happens in 2020, in 2024, you're looking at one or more high-profile women running for president of the United States, some that we know have been a known quantity for a while now, like Nikki Haley, some who have, I think, burst on the scene more recently for many, like Kristi Noem up North Dakota way, South Dakota way. So that's exciting, too, regardless of how the field shakes out, is to have candidates like a Haley or a Noem in the 24 mix.
Yeah, and it's nice to see some diversity up there. It's also fun to prove the left wrong when they say that Republicans are the party of old white men and that we have no diversity and they're the pro-woman party. It's fun to see and be able to show them, what we've known all along, that that's simply not true. But now look for yourself. To your point, you're probably going to have a Nikki Haley run, a Kristi Noem run. That is so exciting. I think the party has a lot to look forward to. And I think having more women up there also helps grow the party and broaden the tent, and that's important long term for the conservative movement.
Well, what do you think about, President Trump says if he doesn't win this time that he's going to run again in 2024. Do you think that's just smoke and mirrors at this point?
I honestly, 2024 feels so far. I feel like we need to finalize this election. But who knows? Working for a Republican women's group, I do think regardless we're going to see not one, not two Republican women running for higher office, and that really excites me.
All right, so we've asked you the easy questions. Now here's the tough one. You mentioned women are not women are not monolithic.
Right.
And so the problem that Republicans have is not really among married women, which Republicans win and President Trump won. The problem is single women. The spread between married women and single women, Trump's percentage of married women versus single women, there's an 18-point spread. And by the way, there's also a deficit for Republicans, married men to unmarried men. So it's a marriage issue. And I wonder, since you're in this milieu, how you've thought about, talked about, game planned the appeal to single women, because unfortunately that seems to be a and single men to some extent, but let's just focus on women, seems to be a growing percentage of the population, thus the electorate.
Yeah. So I think it's no secret what a lot of these women disliked about the president oftentimes, the tone, the rhetoric, the tweets. But I do like to remind people that the Republican Party has long struggled appealing to this demographic, that this isn't a new problem, and it's certainly one that predates the president. I do think we've seen 3 out of 4 Republicans now think that having more Republican women on the ballot helped pull in more female voters. We've seen a majority of Republicans who now think that having more Republican women in office makes sure that Republican women across this country and women more generally are represented. So I do think that one of the best ways that the Republican Party can better resonate and appeal to this demographic and the single woman voter is by having more women on the ticket so that they can hear from different voices in the party. And at times hear someone who maybe looks and sounds a little bit more like them, who can relate a little bit more to them. And I do think that that does a better job generally for the party to kind of improve its outreach and grow the tent and diversify and pull these voters in. I also think the left going so far to the left is an opportunity for the Republican to pull these voters in and pull them into the fold and explain to them why conservatism is the best thing for them.
She is Olivia Perez-Cubas, Director of Winning for Women, former Media Director for Senator Marco Rubio's presidential campaign as well. Olivia, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, thinking about these oppressive house count, Thanksgiving lockdown orders. There have been a number of sheriffs who've spoken out to say that we're not going to enforce them, that we can enforce them.
Good.
One is Chief Andrew Kudick. He is a Howell Township, New Jersey sheriff. He had this to say on Fox and Friends over the weekend.
I'm out there in the community driving around, and I see how much they're hurting. So as a police chief in charge of 100-plus police officers, I felt it was just incumbent upon me just to let them know and my community know that we're not going to basically enforce some of these executive orders, which I feel are basically draconian. We all know we're not going to be used to go door to door on something like that, whereas we're checking to see how many people are gathered for Thanksgiving, especially when political activities are exempt from the executive order.
Mm. And I'm thinking what's going on in Oregon. The governor there, Kate Brown, she wants residents to call the police on their neighbors over Thanksgiving if they have more than six people in their home.
Well, that was the Buffalo incident that we played at the end of last hour with those businesses that were all staged at a health club in Buffalo to protest the lockdown policy. Somebody snitched on them, and that's why the health inspector came out, and then they drove the health inspector and the sheriff's police out. But it is interesting because it goes back to this exchange that Cuomo had last week with a reporter about enforcement. And both the reporter's question and Cuomo's answer start from the premise of legitimacy. It's just a question of ability. It's not a question of legitimacy. The state's authority. Does the state have the authority to do this versus the state's ability to enforce it? Those are two different questions. And for too many of these orders, we're starting from the premise of, oh, well, the state has the authority, but they'll never be able to do it. Be able is one thing. They have no business attempting to be able to do it is another. And that seems to me where that sheriff was going, that sheriff from New Jersey. And that's where we need to drive the conversation. Challenge the bases for these advisories / edicts.
It's not,
not
the
just
law.
The question of the ability to actually enforce them.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Welcome back to the show, Dan and Amy, and thank you for joining us. Sidney Powell was making the rounds end of last week into the weekend after the Thursday press conference, restating some of the claims that were made at that press conference and actually making even bigger ones. Or additional ones of the same sort of size. She was on with Eric Bolling. You remember him from Fox News.
Yeah.
Now he's got his own show. This is what she said about the forthcoming complaints and the contents of said.
Exactly. They can watch the voting real time. They run a computer algorithm on it as needed to either flip votes, take votes out, or alter the votes to make a candidate win.
So that's different. Now you're, this is even different. I just really want to be very, very careful here and be very meticulous about this. It's one thing to be able to watch it and decide how much more input you need to change the number. But now you're saying there's an actual way to change the total, the vote tallies within the system?
That's exactly right.
That's a very, very big claim there. I mean, that would be voter fraud defined right there. What's the next step?
It's massive criminal voter fraud writ large across at least 29 states. It could have been happening. Anytime a voting machine was connected to the internet, and we have evidence that many were, it was obviously happening. It's obvious from the algorithm and the statistics that our experts are tracking out for batches of votes and when the curves changed. And it's going to blow the mind of everyone in this country when we get it all together and can explain it with the affidavits and the experts that have come forward.
All right.
Going to blow the mind, okay. She said on Newsmax in a separate and distinct interview as to, you know, her 29 states. Well, what's the size of this conspiracy? How many people are involved?
We've got tons of evidence. It's so much, it's hard to pull it all together.
How big of a, you know, if this happened, how big of a conspiracy? How many people would have had to have been in on something like this?
Oh, gosh. Probably thousands, including the people running the machines at each of the polling centers. We know, for example, that one of the higher-ups of Dominion went to Detroit the night of the election to handle things himself. And we also have evidence that there were any number of VPN lines open to the internet for foreign actors to be meddling in it.
Thousands of people across 29 states. Well, Michael Steele, that's Steele without an E, not the former RNC chairman, but a longtime political operative in Republican circles in D.C., is now the PR hired gun for Dominion Voting Systems, since that's Sidney Powell's focus, along with Smartmatic, the software provider. And he went on Fox News this weekend, again, representing Dominion Voting Systems. So he's representing a client, just as she ostensibly is. And he said this about Dominion and about the ability to switch votes.
This is a nonpartisan American company. It is not physically possible for our machines to switch votes from one candidate to the other. Let's be very clear. Our election system is run by local elected officials and nonpartisan poll watchers. We simply provide a tool to count the ballots and to print and count ballots. There is no way such a massive fraud could have taken place. And there are no connections between our company and Venezuela, Germany, Barcelona, Kathmandu, whatever the latest conspiracy theory is.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, our elections are not administered by nonpartisan poll watchers. They're administered mainly by partisan election judges, but okay. And his argument as terms of Dominion voting systems fail-safe, the printed ballot.
Well, it's physically impossible. Look, when a voter votes on a Dominion machine, they fill out their ballot on a touchscreen. They're given a printed copy, which they then give to a local election official for safekeeping. If any electronic interference had taken place, the tally reported electronically would not match the printed ballots. And in every case where we've looked at, in Georgia, all across the country, the printed ballots, the gold standard in election security, has matched the electronic tally.
Yesterday evening, the Trump campaign issued a statement. The legal team issued a statement that was rather surprising. Quote, Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. She is not a member of the Trump legal team. She is not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity, from Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis. This was subsequently received as something that is perfectly uneventful, nothing to see here. Sidney Powell saying she agreed with the release. I understand today's news release. I'll continue to represent we, the people who had their votes for Trump and other Republicans stolen by massive fraud through Dominion and Smartmatic, and we will be filing suit soon. General Flynn's son tweeting out, and of course he represents General Flynn, that this allows Sidney Powell to be free to focus and not be tied to having to vet everything through the campaign.
I smell a rat. I don't know. I mean, Trump tweeted before that she's part of the legal team. On Thursday, she was there for that two-hour press conference alongside Ellis and Giuliani. So,
well, she is part of the legal team.
What
they're saying is this formal separation, even though she was never formally retained, this former public separation allows her to be free to focus and not be tied to having to vet everything through the campaign. Maybe. I don't know. The failure of the Trump legal team and the Trump campaign to provide more context to the need for this public statement is a bit curious and confusing, and I think generally unhelpful. For more on all of this, trying to unpack all of this, which is not an easy thing, we're pleased to be joined by John Hinderaker. He is the president of the Center for the American Experiment and the founder of PowerlineBlog.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be with you, Dan.
So how did you assess the formal separation of Sidney Powell from the formal legal team for the president?
Well, I think there's an overriding reality here. Sidney Powell has said over and over, including at that press conference where she was introduced as part of Trump's legal team, that's what they said.
Right.
She has said over and over again that she has this enormous amount of evidence supporting this, you know, frankly, rather bizarre theory against Dominion voting systems. The time has come. I mean, she claims to have evidence, but she won't say what it is. She won't make it public. And you know, one gets the kind of sickening feeling that the explanation is the usual one. That is, she doesn't actually have the evidence.
Well, then she even said over the weekend in Newsmax that Georgia's governor, excuse me, Brian Kemp, is being complicit, even suggesting that he was bribed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. She is in crazy town. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, we all know Tucker Carlson invited her to come on his show, said, look, I'll give you the whole show. Come on. You know, you lay out this evidence that you've got. And, of course, she wouldn't do it. And now the Trump legal team has disowned her and disavowed her. I don't think we're going to see any evidence from Sidney Powell. And I have to say that the way this whole thing has played out is disappointing. It certainly does not appear that there's a lot of high-quality legal work being done or that Trump's legal team was really ready. You know, they must have known that what's happened here was a possibility, and they don't seem to have had a very good plan.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Sidney Powell, it's one thing if you say, look, this is a lot to pull together. I mean, she's somewhat said this, but not exactly. She's like, look, I get it. I get people and see the evidence, and you're going to see it. But this is a lot to pull together. She sort of said it in that clip that you heard, the overwhelming evidence, the difficult thing is processing it all. And, you know, at a date and certain, before the relevant deadlines, I'll be filing complaints in court that provide all of this evidence and make out our claims and seek a particular remedy. But she hasn't been... She's focused more on sort of statements that you would hear from a pundit on a news program or talk program rather than statements you would hear from a formal prosecutor when she uses phrases like blowing up the state of Georgia is what I'm going to do first and so on and so forth. She seems I don't know. It's bizarre because she is the serious person. She does have fairly strong legal credentials, but she just doesn't seem to be particularly grounded in this moment.
Well, there's also just an absence of reality here. She's talking about prospectively filing lawsuits in the future. I mean, good Lord, the Electoral College meets next month. There's going to be an inauguration on January 20th. I mean, the time has come. If she's got evidence, her real audience is the people of the United States. I mean, if this evidence exists, we need to see it, and we need to see it right now. I'm afraid that the truth is that it doesn't.
Switching gears, talk a little bit about that Georgia Senate runoff we've been talking about, too. Kim Strassel wrote about it last week in the Journal, saying the same thing, essentially, we were saying earlier in the week, which is, you know, do not take these races for granted with the Senate hanging in the balance. The effort underway from Stacey Abrams groups and others to register the incremental number of voters they think they need to get over the top, and both of the races right now are statistical dead heats. So what's your handle on those Senate runoffs and where the biggest upside for Loeffler and Perdue may be?
Well, on paper, you know, you would say that the Republicans should win for several reasons. One, in both of those races, the Republican candidates got more votes than the Democratic candidates by, you know, by a fairly significant margin. Two, there are a lot of voters who like divided government. And I think there are some independent voters in particular who, on the assumption that Joe Biden has won the presidential election, you know, however, you know, fair or foul, that Joe Biden is going to be our next president, I think there are quite a few independent voters who would say, that being the case, I'd like to see a Republican Senate. So I think that's going to be helpful to the two Republicans. And the third thing is that the eyes of the world are going to be on Georgia. I think it's going to be very hard for the Democrats to cheat. So I don't think they can count on a large amount of voter fraud in those runoff elections. So you put those three things together, and on paper, I would say the Republicans are, you know, should be favored.
How do you think Kelly Loeffler is going to do? I mean, now she's been diagnosed with COVID, so she can't be out on the campaign trail. Is that going to hurt her chances to hold her seat?
She's not all that great a campaigner anyway, Amy. I don't think so. I mean, I think at this point everybody understands the stakes. And I think there's going to be so much attention, so much hysteria. I don't think that kind of a factor makes any difference.
Thinking about the COVID lockdown policies as we enter Thanksgiving and the Thanksgiving holiday, and some of these governors seeming to try to outdo one another in terms of the stringency of the advisories / orders when it comes to how you can exist in the privacy of your own home. This an issue going forward for Republicans to prosecute, not just in the Senate runoffs in Georgia, which probably less of an issue there because of the governor and because of the approach they've taken, but just sort of more generally as we go into the distribution of vaccines that are coming online and into potentially a Biden administration.
Well, I hope so. You know, I've been appalled, Dan, and I think you have been too, by the sheep-like quality of the American people. You know, their willingness to just nod their heads and go along with these unprecedented shutdown orders. Now, in my state, Minnesota, our governor has just re-shut down all bars and restaurants completely, has shut down gyms. There's no empirical basis for it, mm-hmm. None. You know, the state's own statistics show that bars and restaurants, to the extent that they can identify the source of an infection, bars and restaurants account for 1.7%. Gyms, a fraction of that, a fraction of 1%. You know, so there's no empirical basis for it. I think these orders are plainly unconstitutional. And I'm appalled, frankly, that we haven't seen more civil disobedience.
And John, I don't know if you heard this, but our governor, you know, we asked him, where are you going to be? Are you going to be in Illinois for Thanksgiving? He said, well, I hope so. Because he already got his wife and his daughter out before he had a second lockdown here in Illinois. So it's rules for thee, but not for me. And it's just sickening.
We have seen that over and over and over again. And, of course, most recently with Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, with the dinner at the French Laundry in Napa Valley, where dinners go for like $850 a pop. And who's he having dinner with? It's a big group. It's illegal under his own order. But among others, he's having dinner with the CEO of the California Medical Association,
right,
and their vice president and chief lobbyist. And I think what's revealing about that, A, it's hypocritical. We've seen this hypocrisy, Governor Whitmer in Michigan. We've seen it over and over and over again. But I think the more important point is that if these people really believed what they're saying, which is that COVID is this deadly, deadly disease, and if you gather together with more than, you know, X number of people outside of your own family, you're at risk of death. If they believed that, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
the fact that they do it themselves shows that they know that they are grossly exaggerating the risks here.
Well, then understand that, and then now think about the context of Newsom, as you described, at that soiree at the French Laundry, and his order in California, or his advisory in California, not just masks, not just the gatherings, cover your mask after each bite of food.
Oh, my God.
Right? eat cover. I mean, that, and then now you watch him gallivanting with these lobbyists and top medical people and so forth at the French Laundry. I mean, talk about the imperiousness of this all, in addition to, as you say, you know, they know they're running a scam, at least to some extent, in terms of the fear they're attempting to engender. And then you have to ask yourself, for what purposes, why? Why would they do that?
Well, and some of them are talking about requiring that masks be worn in your own house.
Right.
You know, so it's you and your wife at home with your masks on. I mean, it's completely insane. And, up until now, I think the polls would suggest that most people have gone along with this. Most people are scared, uncertain, don't understand the data. And I think early on, these kinds of draconian orders were unfortunately popular in most states. Now, hopefully that's changing.
Well, when is this charade going to end? When and if Biden takes office?
I don't know. You know, a lot of people thought, well, this is all about the election. When the election is over, these people will say, you know, never mind, life goes on. I don't know at this point. I mean, the vaccine is probably going to be widely available, what, in the spring, something like that? And the spring is also, you know, right now we're in the flu season, right? And so across the upper Midwestern states, cases are rising dramatically. Well, why is that? Well, it's because we're getting to the flu season. That's why. You know, this is a seasonal flu virus.
But the flu here got replaced with COVID. I mean,
that's exactly right. No, that's right. Nobody is catching the flu anymore.
No one's got the flu.
Now
it's all gone. Yep.
Now it's, exactly. Now it's all COVID. So two things are going to happen in the spring. One, the vaccine becomes widely available. I think that's the timing, maybe even sooner than that. We'll see. And two, cases are probably going to start declining as the weather warms up. And so, you know, I think the most realistic hope is that these governors, all of whom, or most of whom anyway, want to get reelected, right? You know, at some point, they really need to declare that their policies have been successful and move on, I think. And
John,
so...
No, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. Finish, John.
So I think probably the spring is when we're actually going to see that.
John Hindraker, founder of the Center for the American Experiment and PowerlineBlog.com. John, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and this story is just delicious, isn't it? An English-language newspaper controlled by the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda department, that would be China Daily, paid U.S. media companies nearly $2 million for printing and advertising expenses over the past 6 months, even amid heightened scrutiny over Beijing's ongoing disinformation campaigns in the West. China Daily paid the Wall Street Journal $85,000, L.A. Times $340,000. From disclosures made that are required under the Justice Department's Foreign Agent Registration Act. China Daily paid Foreign Policy Magazine. Oh, there you go. Establishmentarian foreign policy rags, internationalist in nature. Foreign Policy gets $100,000. Financial Times in the UK, $223,000. $132,000 for Canadian for Canada's Globe and Mail. $110,000 for the L.A. Times. $92,000, Houston Chronicle, $76,000, the Boston Globe. I say this because isn't it fun how the D.C. press corps and their outlets around the country, the major dailies, along with big tech, are happy to do the bidding for some of the most brutal regimes on the planet and yet spend all of their time worried about the one-off conservative donor group who, you know, starts an outlet. You know, they're really worried about delisting the Washington Examiner. Or otherwise censoring, you know, standard issue conservative outlets. But, you know, taking money from China, running interference for China and other despotic regimes, not a problem. For more on this, particularly the big tech piece, we're pleased to be joined again by Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn. Senator Blackburn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, delighted to join you. Thank you for having me on today.
I know you were one of those who had a go at Zuckerberg and Dorsey the last time the two gentlemen appeared before the Senate, the relevant Senate committee, along with Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and others. And, you know, I think the frustration among conservatives is, and frankly, even some of the senators, as expressed by Josh Hawley, is to say that the hearings are useful. It's important to whistle these guys before the Senate and have them answer questions and have the American public be able to hear the quality of the questions and answers and assess the information themselves. But at some point, the Republicans need to decide what it exactly it is they want to do and pursue doing it. And I think people are impatient for something to be done about big tech.
Well, and we do have my legislation, the Online Freedom and Viewpoint Diversity Act, and I've been joined by both Chairman Graham of Judiciary Committee and Chairman Wicker of Commerce Committee, the two committees that have this jurisdiction. And that is the reform bill for Section 230. And that bill was filed back in September. It is ready to be marked up in Judiciary. The hearing that we had last week was in part a fact-finding hearing in support of passing that legislation. So we are doing something. Now, I will tell you this. We have tried. I've worked on this Section 230 issue for 3 years, and it has been very difficult to get support to move legislation forward. And, yes, it does take a while, but also, Dan, the issue of privacy, all this data mining and selling your data and invading your personal you, as I call it. That is something that we have worked on for 8 years, and we finally have bipartisan agreement on that bill. It is moving through the Senate. My hope is that we are going to see that passed very soon, and that we will have a federal privacy standard with one set of rules for the entire internet ecosystem with one regulator, the Federal Trade Commission, and that we will end this practice of the big tech companies data mining you, selling your information to the highest bidder, and how they go in and assume they have rights. It would give you, the consumer, the right to say, no, big tech, you cannot follow me, you cannot censor me, you cannot have access to my information unless I give explicit consent.
Well, Senator, do you think the big tech companies are going to follow this? And what would the penalties be?
If we put it in law, they're going to have to follow it. If we reform Section 230, they're going to have to form it. See, with Section 230, what they've done is to just run wild with hiding behind the liability protections. If we tighten that up so that we're giving people more freedom and taking it away from big tech, we define when and how you can use Section 230 provisions, and we would then preserve Section 230 for new entrants in the marketplace, like Parler. And new search engines, or newer search engines, like Bing and DuckDuck. So we also define who is a publisher, who is a content creator. And, you know, what some of these tech companies have done is to go in and close down websites or close down social media sites for people like the Federalists because they don't agree with something in the comment section. So we define that. We also remove some language that has been nebulous, like the term otherwise objectionable on content. And this is how they have said, oh, this, that, or the other doesn't meet our quote-unquote community standards or terms of service, because their content moderator found it objectionable. So we replace that with explicit language like unlawful or incite terrorism or cause personal harm. So, and then you have a regulator, the FTC, who has been our nation's online regulator since day one, who has the enforcement capacity on that. likewise with privacy and that online privacy issue, you have the FTC as your regulator with the enforcement capacity.
And so yeah, just to make this concrete, you know, one of the examples of concern from conservatives is, okay, you want to strip Section 230 protections from big tech, but you know, if I run a conservative blog, I had this very conversation with William Jacobson, who's a Cornell law professor who runs Legal Insurrection. Am I then going to have legal exposure for what somebody publishes in the comments section on my blog? Am I going to be considered a publisher then and have the same legal exposure that they're talking about for Facebook or Twitter? And so how would you respond to that?
No, it would not give you exposure for something someone says in your comment section. That's the kind of practice that we are seeking to end, because they've shut down sites because they did not like something that came up in the content section. Comment section. Now, they also will censor people, not give a reason. Let me give you an example of that. We all know the Trump Accountability Project is something that AOC, the Squad, some of Pete Buttigieg's staffers are starting because they want to blacklist people that supported for, voted for, worked in the Trump administration. I had put up a post that in the United States of America, we do not create blacklist and try to ruin the lives, kill the careers of people who disagree with us politically. And this is I fight every day to protect the free speech of people who disagree with me on issues, but they have a right to their opinion. So I put that post up that we do not do these blacklists in this country.
Good for you.
Facebook then blocked my post. So I brought this up to Zuckerberg because I said nothing about the election. I said nothing about the election results. I simply said, we don't do that here in the United States. We have a history of respecting robust, respectful political debate, having a point, having a counterpoint. And it was astounding to me that they chose to block that or censor that post.
Now, Senator Blackburn, I just wanted to move along to pressing issues with the presidential election. A number of Republican senators came forward over the weekend saying it's time for President Trump to finally end this and concede. Where do you stand?
I think that President Trump deserves his day in court. The left named themselves the resistance the day after he won in 2016. And they made a commitment that they were going to block, obstruct, make every day miserable. They have put him and this country through a living hell for 4 full years. We had Russia, we had Ukraine, we had impeachment, we had post office scandal. We have had them block him at every turn. So if it takes 4 weeks to figure out what happened with this election, let's take 4 weeks and let's figure it out. But I'm going to stand with President Trump on this. And I think that Joe Biden and his team have everything they need right now. And let's figure out who actually won, what happened with these voter rolls that people who had been dead for a dozen years. I talked to somebody, their previous homeowner had died 12 years ago. They had been in their house 11 years, and the deceased individual got a mail-in ballot. I mean, the left mailed these things out like it was a publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes notice. Fill it out, send it in if you want to participate. Then you had these ballot harvesters going around and collecting these unused ballots. You had them filled out, sent in. Then when you separate the signature cards from the ballot, you don't know if it is a ballot that was harvested or if it is you casting your vote. So we do need to get to the bottom of this. We need to do it before these Georgia runoffs on January 5th. So I'm sticking with the president on this one.
In a prospective Biden administration, if that's what comes to pass, what is the issue that you and your colleagues on the Senate Republican Caucus are most discussing in terms of the need to work in solidarity with one another to prevent, you know, is it Green New Deal? Is it some of what Joe Biden's already been talking about, for example, with the college loan forgiveness plan? What would it be?
One of the things that I am going to be focused on is dealing with China, making certain that we hold them to account. They took our jobs. They sent us this virus. I'm also focused on this technology accountability and making certain that that we deal with Section 230 and that we deal with online privacy so that these companies don't own the virtual you, so that you own your virtual you. We also need to be paying attention to great power competition and what China is doing there in the military space, their aggressiveness. We also should be encouraging our state legislatures to pass the necessary rules and laws at the state level, implement the necessary rules so that these local communities clean up these voter rolls. That is a responsibility of your local county election commission. So every county in this country should make it a priority to know who has moved away and who is deceased, and they should be cleaning up these voter rolls so that we nip this problem in the bud.
She is United States Senator Marsha Blackburn. She is a Republican from Tennessee, where a lot of former Chicago residents now live. Senator Blackburn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
A little bit ago, we heard from a sheriff in New Jersey who's not going to enforce Governor Phil Murphy's lockdown orders for Thanksgiving, you know, the limits on gatherings in your home and stuff. Now, hear from those who had a few choice words for Phil Murphy when they saw him out for dinner last night with his family, mm-hmm. sans masks.
Oh, my God, it is.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, my God, Murphy.
How
you
doing?
Such a...
You're having fun with your family. In the meantime, you're having all kind of other bullshit going on in your house.
A little too drunk?
No, I'm not drunk, as a matter of fact.
Can you put your mask on? Please?
You can go f*** yourself. How's that?
I don't have a mask on.
Stick where the
sun
don't
need a mask? Because there ain't nothing
like
f***ing
Trump,
wrong with me.
I like your Trump phone.
You're
case.
F***ing right.
Guess
you
who
do.
Trump likes? He likes my dad.
Yeah, no, he doesn't like your phone.
Oh, he does.
Get the f*** out of here. Thank you.
I love when people say that.
I just, you know,
I can hear that all day.
Send the Jersey girls out after him. That's all you need.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the good news out this morning that the Oxford AstraZeneca group has developed a vaccine they believe is between 62 and 90% effective, depending on the dosage. Sort of the handle is 70%. So this goes along with Moderna and Pfizer that are moving with alacrity to a vaccine to market. The head of Operation Warp Speed saying that he expects the first Americans will start to be inoculated with the vaccine, probably Pfizer's first to market, by like December 11th or 12th.
That's great news. Should we be celebrating this?
It would seem to be, but at the same time, we have ever more confiscatory lockdown policies, so it's a little bit hard to reconcile the two. But the vaccine, the vaccines coming online, of course, calls to mind a number of other logistical but also ethical issues, including who should be first in line. For more of that discussion, pleased to be joined again by Dr. Sally Satel, a resident from the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
So on the distribution of the vaccine, particularly in the early stages, there's this rank order prioritization, and there's some disagreement among researchers. There's what the Fauci's and the CDC and the National Academy of Sciences say, and there's what researchers at places like Johns Hopkins suggest about what makes sense in terms of rank order priority. How do you see the prioritization? And I know you've written about the insinuation of racial politics into this, which is, of course, inevitable, but also dangerous. But, you know, how we should think about the distribution of the vaccine, since not everybody who wants it can get it at the same time.
Well, it's very complicated. So by no means is this easy. And there should be, it's completely expectable that there would be some controversy because, you know, public health experts and bioethicists are really juggling four considerations, especially if they're thinking about this in terms of groups, you know, which groups to prioritize. And the first is, you know, who's at high risk? Actually, I'm not even putting these in rank order. Just saying one is group risk, which groups are at the highest risk of exposure, which groups play the most critical role in maintaining the healthcare system and keeping society running, which groups are most likely to transmit the virus to others, and who's most likely to die. And it's not clear which go first, with the exception, I should say, of healthcare workers. There's pretty much universal agreement that healthcare workers who were exposed on a regular basis, you know, would come first. And there's also general consensus that those with vulnerable illnesses, those who are immunosuppressed, those with cancer, other kinds of conditions would go first. Those vulnerabilities make them more susceptible, both to probably infection and also to dying if they catch it. But after that, it's complicated. In the UK, for example, they're considering prioritizing after that by age. I've heard some suggestions that maybe we should do it by zip code, because the real point when it comes to other vulnerable groups are people who are, you know, exposed in the course of their daily lives. They're not people like me. I'm very fortunate I can work from home. These are folks who have to take public transportation. They are in jobs where they interact with the public a lot. They often live, if they're lower income, they may live in households that tend to be crowded. And all these put people at risk. And in fact, the National Academy National Academies of Medicine actually do suggest that we prioritize according to a social vulnerability index that takes into account poverty, unemployment, health insurance, other socioeconomic vulnerabilities. And I think that makes sense because fundamentally we want to prioritize by who is at risk. And this is where the suggestion that we might give some priority to people according to race becomes problematic. Because even though race does correlate, at least African-American and Hispanic race ethnicity does correlate with rates of infection, there's no question about that, and even mortality, it's really the risk. It's really the fact that these folks tend to be disproportionately represented in the lower income groups, in those groups I mentioned before that have to take public transportation and work in jobs that are with the public and so on. So it's really the risk that is the cause. The race is just the correlate. And when we're working with public health, we have to pay attention to cause.
And where do children come in all of this, and teachers, and hopefully getting, you know, back to some normalcy with kids actually learning with their teachers standing in front of them?
Yeah, I thought a very smart op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week suggesting that teachers be right under, you know, if you're rank ordering, close to the top.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think that makes a lot of sense. I hope.
Well, Well, wait a second. So this is my confusion in these discussions. So how does that make sense if it's based on vulnerability? Because we know what the incidence of transmission is professionally for teachers to the extent that, you know, they're even in the classroom at present. It's the same thing that daycare workers I saw listed in the top three. Why? There's a Yale study of 57,000 childcare centers that found basically nil transmission. So, I mean, I get theoretically you say, oh, well, this is, teaching is important, so we want to inoculate teachers. Yeah, okay, I agree, teaching is important, but if it's based on the risk that you present, the environment and the risk, then actually teachers and daycare workers doesn't make sense in terms of priority.
Well, I did mention at the beginning that there were about four kinds of imperatives to juggle, and one of those four was what is the group that plays a critical role in maintaining society? And teachers and kids being in school so their parents can work has a big role in maintaining the economy.
Yeah.
So that's another variable to juggle.
Right.
That's why it's so darn complicated.
Well, yeah, I mean, right. I mean, it's darn political, which is why it gets darn complicated, I suppose. I mean, Johns Hopkins takes, a bit of a counterintuitive approach. They said actually prioritize young people, even though their risk is low, that you have you put them back into a general
right.
population, as it were, put them back into society, and actually with them inoculated, that it overall reduces the spread, and it will ultimately lead to more lives saved.
Yes, and again, I come back to those four things I mentioned, and the one was, are certain groups more likely to transmit the virus than others? And those would be the kids, exactly, because even though they themselves are not that vulnerable to illness, yeah, they can. So that's why it's so tough. But when I was focusing on risk, I was thinking in the context of race, and that's where race itself does not increase risk. It's the social correlates of race. In other words, again, the social vulnerability.
Right,
but,
and as you mentioned in your piece too, that the whole race thing, you can play the race card a few different ways. On the one hand, you say, well, it should be blacks and Latinos first because of the higher incidence, and as you say, the correlation between socioeconomic status. And on the flip side, you get some black Americans saying, well, wait, I'm not taking the vaccine first. I'm not going to be your guinea pig. You know, I mean, so, some people you can't win for losing.
Well, that's true. That's very true. Frankly, there's not enough, willingness to take the vaccine among all Americans. I mean, even among whites, when asked by, I think it was a Harris stat poll, and they were said, if the vaccine were over 90%, effective, and this was before the Pfizer announcement. So they weren't anticipating could have such potential success with it. And they said if it were 90% effective, only 2/3 of all Americans would take it, and it was about 50% for African Americans. And so, frankly, everyone, I would hope the vaccine hesitancy would start to melt across the country, but the resistance is disproportionately higher among African Americans. And, they will invoke the Tuskegee experiment from, that ended in 1972, but that's a classic example of, abuse of a group to allegedly advance science. It had to do with, it was a syphilis study in which.
Yes, right.
But
what that really speaks to, which is sort of interesting, because I think that there's a that speaks to, thinking about the Tuskegee experiment, is I don't trust the public health officials. I don't trust the institutions. And what you have here now across the board, that transcending racial categories, maybe from different angles, but transcending race, is a lot of I don't trust because of the pronouncements made by so many public health officials, like that this was received wisdom from on high that has turned out not to be received wisdom and has turned out to really be only the only end result is not necessarily saving lives at all, in addition to negatively impacting the quality of my life for an extended period of time, much longer than was initially suggested.
Right, there is a lot of distrust, and that's actually a kind of a free-floating problem that, that doctors and public health have to deal with. But in this particular example, I think it was also exacerbated by, ironically, the name of the operation, you know, Operation Warp Speed, which sounds great, and it was Warp Speed, and it's all apparently, we're not done yet, but it looks so promising, and this seems like an enormous success, but the name implies that we rush this through. And so some people are cautious about that. And then there was a, you know, an animosity towards President Trump. And so anything that he was behind, and especially to the extent that he wanted this revealed before the election, that didn't happen. But that also created, you know, a fair amount of anxiety and suspicion as well. So, yeah, it's clearly a very much a social phenomenon as well as a medical one.
And Doctor, I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier about kids, they're not vulnerable, but they can spread the disease to people at home. Are there any proven cases at all of student-to-teacher transmission or of student-to-parent transmission that you know of?
I wouldn't say kids are not vulnerable, but they're much less vulnerable to becoming sick. I'm not aware, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Okay. With respect to that trust issue and credibility, do you find this to be the case? The unwillingness to incorporate studies in discussions that run against whatever the countervailing wisdom is, whatever the prevailing wisdom is. There's no opportunity for any countervailing input. So, for example, over the last couple of weeks, two studies, one from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, another from a group of Danish researchers that suggest that mask wearing is basically ineffective. It basically has no impact. In point of fact, in the Icahn study done with the U.S. Marines, those U.S. Marines that did not wear masks were infected at a lower rate than the Marines that were on lockdown wearing double cloth masks or double surgical masks for the period of the experimentation. But yet I don't hear any of that conversation. All I just hear is more mask zeitgeist. Even your colleague, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, over at American Enterprise Institute, writing the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, is not reconsidering mask wearing as some sort of half-assed panacea, to be blunt about it. But he's talking about, we need to wear better quality masks. Well, right, because we know an N95 is better than a surgical, is better than a cloth. Well, I know. We've known that for 8 months. So why are you saying it now? What's the magic now? The unwillingness to address peer-reviewed academic studies that don't comport with the policy you're currently proposing, I think is a real credibility destroyer.
Well, I think you're right about that. I think we still have a lot more research to do, but often when things get presented in the media, it's as if this is the final word, when often they are kind of provisional words. And so then when another study comes out that disagrees with it, it's confusing and people get whiplash. And then, of course, these studies are very complicated, extraordinarily complicated to parse. A lot of times they're done with models, and models are only as good as the assumptions, and sometimes the assumptions are wrong. So sometimes it's not that much of a surprise that you get different answers, but it's incredibly confusing to the public. I understand that. And I believe I was on your show after George Floyd, and we talked about, and to me, this is frankly one of the most stunning statements I've ever seen by a public health official, or she was an academic, but a much quoted academic at Johns Hopkins, that I'm paraphrasing only slightly, but it's okay to get out there and march because this is a good cause.
Right.
And that was before we realized, you know, if you're outside and you're not on top of everyone, someone else screaming, you're probably going to be okay. I mean, the march last week? Here in Washington, D.C., the Trump supporters, a lot of them were wearing masks, and they were, the point is, you know, we're not hearing about outbreaks from that.
And it's, you know, it's just the larger issue, too. Anybody who says the science, to your point, anybody who says the science is settled is not a serious person, because the science is never settled. That's the point of science. But yet we're told by these... were told by these politicians and these TV scientists that the debate is over, the science is settled, even as research is going on that's finding out new things or finding out things that we thought were new or old.
Yeah, you just actually touched on one of my pet peeves is the way people use the word science. Science, when they say science says, I understand what they mean, but it does imply that this is a definitive result, and in many cases, as you say, it's provisional, and science doesn't say anything. The data say something, and those data, as you note, can change over time as we know more. Science is a methodology. It's how we approach a question and try to look at it in the most controlled way and account for other variables that can produce an outcome, but it's a method. And it's the data and the evidence that show you something, and that evidence is often, not always, I mean, some evidence is just pretty darn solid, and we should follow it. But there are certain topics where the data are still subject to revision, and this is one of them.
She is Dr. Sally Satel, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.